All right. Last week we looked at chapter 7, and that's where I want to finish off the questions tonight, and then get into chapter 8 on words of wisdom in view of God's providence in life. And we'll hopefully get through chapter 8 this evening. Just a second. I thought I had. Well, we aren't going to go back to those. I thought I had questions, the last three questions there from last week, but I didn't. So, okay, we'll get started in chapter 8 and verse 1. Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? The man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. That statement, who is like a wise man, the interpretation of that, or saying it just exactly like it is, and the Hebrew is a little bit more difficult, something like who shows to be wise, who acts in a wise way, who is one that appears to be wise, I guess you would say, and that's seen by his action or his visage or something in that way, that it's a question mark of look out and see who it is that you can recognize as wise by the way that they are. And he says, of that wise one, I think this is just a follow-up to that as you get it in that second phrase, who knows the interpretation of a thing? The idea is who knows the meaning of something, that which is how things fit together, simply the sense of wisdom, not just being knowledge, but knowledge that's applied. In other words, who knows how to apply and give full understanding of that which is known? That would be the wisdom of being seen there. Then he adds a couple of phrases that are here. Not the way we would use this term, but I think we have parallels as well. A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. How does a man show wisdom in his face? You ever think about that one? Do we have a saying kind of like that? Okay. Go ahead. Okay. Good ideas. Anybody else there? When you talk about the wisdom making the face to shine, you look at someone and you recognize a kind of a wisdom that shows on the face, it seems to me, in various ways. I think our way of saying that was that the light bulb kind of goes on in the mind, you know, when somebody has that kind of a deal. You can almost see that in their face, and that seems to be the sense of what this is talking about. The sternness of his face changing, I think Kurt's point is right there, that you look at this and you look at anger and you see opposites. Anger is obvious to see on the face, and, you know, somebody tells you, they say something, and they say, I'm not angry, really. You know, that's not something that's all that hard to tell. You can recognize that. And that point is that wisdom controls that and doesn't have that rashness in the anger, that kind of sudden lashing out or an obvious point that's made there. Go ahead, Cindy. Certainly, that wouldn't help with a response in the same way, because then you merely ramp it up. But the wisdom would recognize that there's a way of handling this with
some calmness to discuss the substance of matters rather than the emotion of them. Anybody else there? He's talking about that if you are this kind of a person, this wise person, then you'll be seen in how you react. And also the point is urging people toward that response of wisdom to recognize especially the things that he's going to talk about that follow here as we look at them. In verse 2, really you've got to go all the way through verse 9. I was looking for how to break this up, but there's not a way. This all fits together. I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the words of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps his commandment will experience nothing harmful. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Because for every matter, there is a time and a judgment, though the misery of man increases greatly. For he does not know what will happen, so who can tell him when it will occur? No one has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, and no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. All this I have seen and applied my heart to know every work that is done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. All right. Overall, when you look at that paragraph, what is it about? What's the subject matter? The background, if you will. What kind of things are we dealing with? What does it start with and end with? Pardon me? Anybody? All right, rulers. The king's commandment you start with in that first verse, and then you get down here, and he talks about one man rules over another. This is a rulership. And so one of the first things that he's going to apply in this matter is, how does a wise man react to those points of some government or rule that's over him, and that enforcement of that? How is he going to deal properly with things? Now, what have you noticed all through your life about those who are in high places of government? Has it been the rule that you've seen that every one of them is just the most wise man that ever existed on the face of this earth, and that's why he got to be a ruler? Have you noticed that? I haven't either. What have you noticed from time to time? Some will be wiser than others, right? Let me ask you something. Does the wise ruler have any more or less of an authority than the foolish ruler? No, he has the same one. And so you've got to look at this, and it helps us to think about this in our cases. You're always going to have rulers who will show wisdom and rulers who will show folly. Now, what does that do? Does that change the way you react and whether or not you're obedient under the law? Well, it should, and that's the point that's being made. You keep the king's commandment for the sake of what? Your oath to God. What does that mean? Did anybody ask, did you take an oath to God to obey the rulers? You may have not overtly done that, but when you put yourself under the law of God, what else have you put yourself under? Under the rulership of the law of the land. And so the point is, you do that. In the New Testament, there had been another way of saying that. Both in Colossians and Ephesians, this is talked about. And the sense is, not for the master's sake do you have that servant that is in obedience, but as unto the Lord. And you have that recognition that
as one who is subjected to God, I accept my place, whatever that might be in life. And therefore, if one is over me and rule in a nation, then I accept that fact. Now, that simply is something that is there regardless of whether there's wise or foolish ones. Sometimes you'll see some people come along and you'll see it from time to time. I've noticed every once in a while you'll get somebody who gets all bothered about the government and they'll start sending out emails about how we should object our income tax and we should not do this and not do that and rebelling against the government. No, we don't do that in times of a wise or a foolish rule. We have a responsibility to show a place of subjection when we're in that subjection, whether it's as one who is to the federal government or to a local government, a state, or whatever you're talking about, whether it's in a relationship to a boss or whatever else that's there. There's a submission, there's a recognition that that one has a place that is over us, and therefore we're one who are under the keeping. That doesn't mean we have to like every law. That doesn't mean it's something that we're thrilled about. But the fact is, we're still in subjection to it. Was it a good government that they liked a lot back in New Testament times? Absolutely not. But remember, that's the government that you find Paul, Peter, and others there by inspiration saying, you subject yourself unto that government. Go ahead, Cindy. We're under that law, and we're subjected to it. Therefore, whether I think it ought to be that speed limit or not, I got to pay that ticket, and I better not complain.
Not the ticket, because that's that is a consequence for violating the law. I'm asking if violating the law is sin, regardless that, of whether you're ticketed.
I don't know that government, a local government or state or whatever, makes law for God. God's law stands alone. Man doesn't add to it. But the idea of subjection is that you put yourself under that. You recognize they have a right to rule in that sort of a way. And so that's the point of submission. The other is a different context from here. But this is the idea of being one that places yourself under submission. Let me put it to you this way. Here's Paul. He had to be ultimately, we're told historically, beheaded because of his faith. Now, did he reject that ruler's right to do that? No. Now, he went on and preached the gospel even though he knew that was going to bring about the beheading. But he recognized their lawful right to rule in that way. Even when kings or presidents or governors or whatever else give a law that's not right, that I even one that I can't obey, I still have to be in subjection. And that's to recognize they have that place of rule, and I'm going to receive whatever the penalty is that is there when they make that law. That's their place.
Then is it just, and I'm not trying to be facetious, I'm really sincerely asking, if I am subjected to man's law, and you say that it would be wrong for me to rally against the government because I don't agree with taxes or whatever I don't agree with, and that would be wrong, then why is it just a physical thing and not spiritual thing that if I don't agree, if I don't choose to obey the laws of the land, then it's just the physical consequences?
You have a law that's broken, and that's the right they have. They don't have the right to write God's law. For instance, you know, you have all kinds of laws with regard to marriage, even to the idea that you have same-sex marriage now. That didn't change God's law. Man can make that legal all he wants to. Now, what do I have to do? I have to accept the law when they say, here's
a law with respect to that, of what's necessary in some prejudice case or whatever else that's there of commerce being cut off to someone who would be out there after homosexual rights. I don't have a right to cut off their commerce rights or anything like that because I don't agree with them. The law of the land's what I've got to accept. Now, in my own conscience, if there's a problem that I have then with saying, I can't go along with that, and that would be going along with that, it would be giving some consent as far as I'm concerned, I've got to keep my conscience. But I can't say, well, the government has no right to do these things. Yes, it does. It has a right. It doesn't have the right to write laws for God, but it has a right to rule in that realm that God has given it a right to rule. Whether it's right or wrong is irrespective of the fact. They still have that right of rule. Anybody else there? Go ahead.
So would the protesting against something of, that the government, say, I'm just saying higher taxes or something, if you protested, you know, now you're paying your taxes, but you're protesting against it.
I think the word that Cindy used, rebellion, if it gets into that, whether it's urging others or whatever else, I might take a second look at that. But if we're talking about a matter where I state my views in a place where I've got a right to state my views, no, as far as I can see, that's there. But when you get into that realm of a rebellion and trying to get others to disobey or to say, you know, they have no right to do this, whatever else, now we're in a realm that is a problem. I love this country, and I'm glad we've got it. I couldn't have rebelled in the Revolutionary War to save my life. I don't see how that would be in accord with what God says about subjection. I'm glad we're here. I'm glad that this has happened. But we need to be ones who recognize whatever is taking place in government, let God deal with that. Let's spend our time dealing with things that are spiritual in their focus. And sometimes we get so wrapped up in the politics and everything else of this world that we forget. Ultimately, we're not really citizens here. Our first citizenship is in heaven, and need to take care of that, focus on that. I saw some hand over here. Did you have one, Renee?
Oh, no, you pretty much answered. I was just going to say that we're blessed to live in this country, that we can, and then laws that we think are fair, we can do that in accordance with our
sure.
Absolutely.
That's true. Those kind of things, that realm of rebellion is where we get a problem with not only this, but direct reflection of what, for instance, 1 Peter chapter 2 talks about. All right. When he says, do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. In other words, the king is going to do what pleases him. If you go against him, then what's going to happen? Put this back, not in our form of government. We tend to put things in terms of American government and read it there. What kind of system was Solomon talking about, and what were the surrounding nations? It was a kingship. It was a monarchy. Now, when the king makes a law and he says this is the way that it is, if I stand up and say, nah, that's not what you should do, then what's probably going to happen with me? Yeah. Either, you know, that way, or at least you're going to be one suffering. And typically, when you went against the authority of a monarch, it wasn't just you that suffered. It was the extended family. If you notice, in some of the more dictatorship-type groups today in the world, you still have that. You don't just take that out on one person who had rebelled. You take it out on the whole family.
That's what happens. And so my actions have a wider consequence than just for me. Says, where the word of the king is, there's power. Why? Because that's what he inherently has. He has that rulership and the power to back it up. There are those who have the sword behind him. And who may say to him, what are you doing? That comes across in the English just like it does in the Hebrew. We would say something like, are you crazy? You know, maybe, or what are you doing? And that's kind of the contemptuous sense. It's a tense of a verb that is used when it has that looking down on or reflecting on someone in that sort of way. And if I'm going to do that, that's, again, going to get me in trouble. He who keeps the commandments, what will happen to him? Nothing harmful. The king's going to be fine with that in that kind of a case. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. This is where I want to take a little bit of time, too, here, because this is going to be a key phrase that we're going to see, not only later in this paragraph, but the concept's going to be repeatedly brought out through this section. What does he mean that this one who is wise, a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment? What did he say about time back in chapter 3? All right, there's a time for everything. A time for this way or that way, opposites. Now, where might that time, if I want to give advice to a king, I might better consider my time to do that. Would it be when I'm in front of everybody and him? If I want to try to suggest something, where might be a better place to do that? Husbands, you want to suggest something to your wife about wise doing things. Do you do that in front of everybody that comes over to the house, or do you wait till that evening and talk with her alone? Same thing with husbands. The idea is you wait for a proper time for that to happen. And so you consider something. You might have a good suggestion to the king, but that might not be the time to bring it up. And judgment. Is it worth it? When you bring up things of a conflict, it's good to consider, is this a conflict that's necessary? Is this really going to do anything to produce a great deal of good? Or is this something that probably would be best to just leave alone? Wisdom tries to look at that. What's the nature? What's going to be the magnitude of the possible good versus the possible bad that would be there? And so that kind of thing is a judgment that I'll want to weigh. Go ahead.
You usually refer to that as picking battles.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think most people can relate to that.
Yeah.
As much as anything, is that if you want to do things, and like you said, you got to pick your battle too.
That's right.
The main thing was timing was everything when it came to asking.
Exactly. Child back there, when they stoned rebellious ones, might not live to that time if they weren't wise in picking that out. So here's the idea, that time and judgment, consider those things. Because why? For every matter, there's what? The time and judgment. For everything that needs to be done, doesn't mean it needs to be done all the time. And it doesn't mean it needs to be done in every case. We've got to consider those matters. Like Stephen pointed out, the pick your battle. I've noticed something when you get into a conflict. When you get into a conflict, you're using up some of your, your goodwill. When you get into that conflict and that goodwill is expended, you don't get it back. And so there's a good sense of recognizing, do I need to get into this and expend that? Because you are going to pay. There's going to be a difficulty that comes along. Anytime there's a conflict, it costs something. And so you decide, is this a time when that goodwill needs to be expended? Because if you do it all the time, is anybody going to listen? Nope. And you know what? The reputation will be, that's the way they are. They're always that kind of a person. It's not wise. So you have to think about when is a good time to have what kind of conflict that's there. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems too in this context, if you don't like something the king's doing, you know, rebelling versus finding that right time to bring up something and say, hey, maybe. I was thinking about
through a problem with health and so forth. And wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. In other words, you can't be one who wins that battle of when you die and when you stay alive through that wickedness. It's not going to help in that sort of a thing. All this I've seen. Now he kind of looks at this and makes a summary point. All this I've seen applied to my heart to every work that is done under the sun. So what's he talking about? Is he talking about the eternal realm? Nope, talking about the physical realm, that which is in this material realm, earthly realm. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. How's that? How could you rule over another and the one who is the ruler be the one who gets up, ends up getting hurt?
He had tremendous power, was granted it, but it ended up killing him.
Okay.
After he got the power.
Rebellions happened back then, too. And a lot of people ended up as emperor or king or whatever, dying in their bed, not because they died in their sleep, because somebody came up and clobbered them in the head while they were asleep. It is something that takes place. That ruling over only goes so far. And when somebody begins to be a tyrant, sooner or later they're going to get the effect of that. And that is seen throughout history as well. How else, though? How could one rule over another man or exercise that kind of authority to his own hurt? Let's put a fool in there as the ruler, okay? He's making laws or making edicts that are foolish, that are going to end up wrecking the economy of that place. Now, what happens? When he ends up wrecking the economy, guess who's hurt? He's hurt too. Typically, when you have a downturn that takes like that in a full range, like a famine or these kind of things that are overall a kind of a breadth of society going down, you tend to have those people who are in power who are suffering a lot. Why? Because they're the ones who've been enjoying the perks. And when they don't have those perks, it's a problem. I remember being over in the former Soviet Union, right as the Soviet Union was going down, the normal people were used to suffering. They didn't have anything. But the guys who are the party men who had been having all the nice stuff, they had the electricity and the coal and the steam to be able to have a nice, comfortable life. They were freezing like everybody else was. And to them, it was just totally intolerable. Well, they had these perks all along, and now they're suffering more. Those are the kind of things that have to do. Sometimes those who are in a place of rule end up having a greater form of the reflection of bad power or foolishness than do the people who are under them. Anybody else got anything there on that?
I was
All right. So he's talking about this sense of the government and its overall use, either with wisdom using their power or without. Now let's go to verse 10. Then I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This also is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God and who fear before Him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. All right, let's remember that earlier he had talked about there are people who you can see prolong their life through wickedness, and those who shorten their life from acting righteously. That's a fact. It happens from time to time. But now he looks at the overall sense of this matter. Not the exception, but what tends to be the rule. Here's somebody who's out there buried. He ends life as a wicked man. But what has he been before? As one in holiness. Said, but the people in the city where he was, they had forgotten about that. Why? This is one that I think when you look at it and see what he's setting up, it's a little bit more evasive in the point than what is sometimes thought. Here goes somebody who starts out as a man of holiness and doing what's right. Now, who is he associating with and who has respect for him? That holy man. Man who's doing what's right before God. Others who are righteous. That's right. You have this one and he's with them. Now he shifts and he goes toward evil and doing wickedness. The people that he shifts to be with in wickedness, are they ever going to trust him fully? Because before he was holy, and he was getting on to them, and he was living in a different way, can they really trust him? No. How about the people who he left, who are still living in holiness? Do they trust him? When you look at this is a truism that happens. When you look at any division among God's people that has taken place, some who apostatize and go away towards innovations, whether it be with instrumental music or the institutions or the social gospel, whatever you want to talk about, you had those who before had objected to that, strongly so, given reasoned arguments to show the truth, and then they swapped to the other side. You know what I've noticed about them? They're not trusted by either side of that. They're a man without a country. Because they've been the same thing, somebody in a physical sense. So patriotism has been a traitor. You see that over and over. I see the people who start to lead in that direction. All they are is used by people who are in the viewpoint of the innovation, that which is not authorized. They're glad. He used to be our enemy, now he's a helper. We still don't like him, is the kind of a sense. The same thing goes with those who had before stood for truth. It cost them. And now late in their life, they go over to the other side, and what happens? They're not respected. They're not remembered in that way because they didn't end the race like they started it out. I think that's the point here. Is when you're talking about either side of that, when it points out they were forgotten in the city where they had so done, where they were first holy, then wicked. It's not that they were considered bad among just one group. What's being pointed out is that's so with both sides of that. Go ahead. Okay.
Because if that's the case, then unless you always knew the truth, you'll never be trusted.
Nope. That went only one direction. Think about it from the standpoint of coming to the truth. What do we believe in as God's people in holiness and righteousness? Forgiveness. And the acceptance of those who have acted in forgiveness. That isn't the policy of the wicked, the one moving from holiness to wickedness. They have no such policy. They don't trust those kind of people who are righteous do. And that's why I'm happy when somebody comes out of worldliness. You're glad to accept them. You're going to try to get them to reach others. Why? Because we have a very different reason for existing. And that basic thing that's there about us is truth, holiness, righteousness is more important than anything else. So somebody who's going to go against that and come to that, that's more important than what they've been. Forgiveness helps with that. That's why among God's people, there ought to be more of an acceptance of those who truly leave sin and come to that which is right. We ought to be fully accepting of them because of that concept of the way God acts. He's forgiven and remembers it no more. Same way we ought to be. Does that kind of go with that? Anybody else there? Go ahead.
I just can't imagine Saul back then. You know, just the reaction from the Christians when he comes in and with all the things he does, you know, we're studying, well, in Acts when he just steps up and does his first lesson, just how leery but amazed all at the same time. You know, mostly amazed that people would be Christians would be.
And how it comes to be that they accept him so much so as the life goes on and they can see by his life that he really has changed. This isn't just a ploy. This is someone who's changed and now he's a great asset to the cause of Christ. All right, anything else there? Now, though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged. In other words, he just keeps on. Seems like the wicked will go on and on forever, we say sometimes. Yet I surely know what? It'll be well. The word well in the Hebrew is a comparative. It's the sense of it'll be better for him. It's a better way of life. It's that which is of increasing goodness might be a way to say that. It will be well for those who fear God, who fear before Him. Why? Why? Go ahead.
His reward is from God.
Okay. Number one, he's done what is his purpose to do. Whether that makes it easier or not on him in this life, he's fulfilled that purpose, and there is a recognition of that, a good that comes in that itself, but beyond that, what? There's the reward that comes from God down the line, we understand as well, and that's what Solomon is looking to here. It will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow. In other words, he can't make them last forever. If you were, let's say, the normal lifespan was 70 and you live by being rich and getting hold of things and sustaining your life for another 20 years, what's that? Now, I look at time right now, and time's a whole lot less appealing to me at this point. And somebody said, man, it'd take me 20 years to do that. And I think, man, 20 years has gone by like a flash. Well, does a 14-year-old think that? No. The point is, you still got a short lifetime in this. You use it in wickedness. You're going to be there as one who does not fear before God. Your life's still going to be a shadow. And the fact of it is, he's going to answer this in the end. What's the ultimate word that would have him recognize that's the wrong way to live in wickedness? Last verse of this book says what? For God will bring every work into judgment. Whether good or evil. Doesn't matter. Whether it's private or not. God will bring everything there. And so that point ultimately has brought out this. This is only kind of pointing to that as you go in this way. Okay. Verse 14. There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked, and again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry, for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him, what? Under the sun. So again, we're talking about this life. Here's somebody out here, he says, there's a just man. It happens to him like to the wicked. Here's a wicked man. It happens to him like the righteous. Is that a good thing? You know what? That just made me think. I forgot to pick up something back here. Let me go back. I'm sorry. Verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. What's the point in that? If a justice system gets so overloaded with things that there is not a result of the wickedness that's seen in a timely way, then what happens? People don't see any consequence to doing evil. And when that happens, what's going to happen? There will be more evil that's there. And that's what you've got in a kind of a system. I see in our country, the average case of a capital punishment I heard the other day was something like 23 years before it's carried out. And they say, well, it doesn't deter. Well, of course it doesn't if it takes that long. Well, that's ridiculous. If you have that kind of a period of time, you've forgotten what happened. There's nobody who really remembers the person who was murdered and all of that. You can't have any kind of a justice that's seen in all of those things. If you don't have, here's the action that was wrong, and here's the result of that wrong, and they come in close proximity, then you've got no deterrent to that crime. You've got every sense of saying, well, I can do it, and I can get by with it. And that's the idea that he's talking about here. Go ahead.
Over the years, they bring up different things and make it that he is not to blame for the situation that has.
Yeah.
And people get sorry and get soft-hearted because he's been detained so long.
Yeah. And they lose the evidence. They do various other things, and he ends up getting off. In many cases. All right. The point here, same one, really. When you have something that it happens to the good guy like it should happen to the bad guy, and it happens to the bad guy like it should happen to the good guy, he says, what do? You recognize that's vanity. It doesn't bring the right principle that's there. So what does he say? Well, enjoy what you've got. Not all justice is done in this world. And we've got to get ready for that. The fact is, there never has been a form of government that's been upon this earth that's been absolute in the way of getting true justice done. That's not going to happen because we're imperfect people. And the fact of it is, whatever kind of system you get is going to be something that's going to have its problems and difficulties with it, whatever. Like I think it was
Churchill who said this, democracy is the worst form of government I know of, except for every other form. And that is the truth. You've got problems, whatever is there. And so, what do? You live your life in a way of recognizing what's right, what's wrong, living according to those values, and enjoying things that you can. Real quick. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on the earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, then I saw the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. Is that the second one? Okay. All right. We'll take up with that next time and then go on into chapter 9 as well.